You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We'll follow that active shooting situation in Milwaukee and bring you details as we have them. You can also follow WPR.org/news. Now, the United Kingdom officially left the European Union last month, and that means the UK has a lot to figure out, like its own immigration policies and its trading relationship with other countries. Our next guest has been thinking about that last point and has some ideas about what a good US-UK trade deal could look like. Representative Mike Gallagher is a Republican member of the U.S. House of Representatives. He represents the state's 8th Congressional District, which includes a section of northeastern Wisconsin and Green Bay. Representative Gallagher, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be with you.
For American and Wisconsin companies in particular doing business with the U.K., what kind of time frame do you look at, a waiting period, before we end up with a direct trade deal with the U.K.?
Well, I hope we don't waste any time. We have trade promotion authority, I believe, at least through 2021. There's a tendency in American politics to delay things until after an election, but I think that would be a mistake because I think we have a unique window here where both of our countries are eager for an agreement. And I think we have a broader opportunity to create really a gold standard trade agreement, one that really sets the standard for free and fair trade and incentivizes other countries down the road to join in. Just given the makeup of our economies, given our history of shared values and cooperation, it makes a ton of sense. Both President Trump and Prime Minister Johnson have both expressed interest in such a deal. But the biggest stumbling block to getting that done, or even starting the debate, is going to be getting an agreement on the future of the internet infrastructure in both our countries, and specifically whether we should allow telecommunications companies like Huawei, which have close ties to the Chinese Communist Party, to compete for the future of the internet. We currently have a massive disagreement with our close allies and friends in the UK on that issue, and we are going to have to resolve that issue first and foremost before moving forward.
You wrote about this recently in the Wall Street Journal, and yeah, you devoted a lot of attention to this issue of Huawei being part of the 5G network in the UK. Expand on that a little. Why should Americans be worried about who's providing 5G in the UK?
The specific concern with Huawei and other Chinese telecommunication companies like ZTE is that they are effectively controlled by the Chinese Communist Party. And if the Chinese Communist Party controls your internet, it controls all of your data, your information. You have no assurances that anything you send online is going to be secure. And ultimately, it builds a backdoor into our networks that might potentially allow the Chinese to shut down infrastructure or networks in the future should, God forbid, we get into a heated kinetic dispute with them. And so there's a counterintelligence concern. There's a security concern. But there's also a bigger concern about if we allow Chinese companies that receive massive subsidies and are from the Chinese government and are thereby able to undercut their Western competitors to the tune of 30%, if we allow them to win this competition, then they're going to drive all their competitors out of business. They're going to dominate and monopolize the global telecommunications market. And we won't have any non-Chinese alternatives when it comes to building 6G and beyond. So the stakes could really not be higher, both economically and in terms of national security. And we've had multiple reports, both open source and otherwise, confirming what is most obvious, which is to say these companies are effectively appendages of General Secretary Xi Jinping and the Chinese Communist Party.
Before we move away from the Huawei part of the story, is that something that we should just be negotiating, you know, between intelligence agencies and national security people? Should we let it stand in the way of a trade deal, or flipping it around, should we be using a trade deal as leverage to make this change?
Well, I actually think it's both, right? I think given our intelligence sharing partnership, the UK is part of what's called our Five Eyes Alliance, the four other allies with whom we share the most information and a ton of intelligence. Given that history, given that operational relationship, we should be making the case more aggressively to our UK partners that if we want that intelligence relationship to continue, we're going to have to resolve this disagreement. But simultaneously, I do think we should use the desire for a trade agreement in the UK as leverage to bring the Brits to our position. Now, there's a lot of different reasons, I think, behind Boris Johnson's decision to allow Huawei to compete in their 5G infrastructure. But I think part of it is just bound up in that overall insecurity, economic insecurity of what does a post-Brexit UK look like. And so I think by saying, hey, if you agree with us on this issue, we stand ready to forge a gold standard trade agreement we kind of get the best of both worlds. We resolve the dispute, but we also resolve some of the ongoing economic insecurity that may be driving this decision in the UK right now.
Talking to Representative Mike Gallagher about a possible trade deal with the U.S. and the U.K. in a post-Brexit world. Representative Gallagher, what are some of the key things you'd like to see then in that trade deal itself, if we can work past that Huawei issue?
Well, I think we have an opportunity to build on some of the successes that we saw in the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement, but also correct some of its deficiencies. So I think the starting point for every gold standard trade agreement should be the complete elimination of all tariffs and quotas. As with previous trade agreements, tariff reductions could be phased in over a number of years in sensitive areas, but the goal should be to remove them completely in less than a decade. Another interesting idea, I think, would be to have something akin to, you know, how global entry or TSA PreCheck works. The idea would be to make it easier for shippers that are cleared to move cargo through points of entry via a pre-approval process so that it's easier for us to ship goods back and forth from the United States to the United Kingdom. I lay out a few other things, but the other thing I'd note, two other things I'd note is we should have a provision that allows other countries that see our gold standard and really want to abide by those high criteria, an easy docking provision that allows them to join the agreement. And finally, in contrast to USMCA, I think we should not have any sunset clause on the agreement. Putting an arbitrary end to the agreement creates uncertainty. It deters trade and investment. So there's just a few ideas there that hopefully will start a broader discussion about, you know, what is the gold standard for a free and fair trade agreement that advantages Wisconsin workers and allows them to do more business with UK companies.
I talked to a Wisconsin trade official not too long ago who pointed out that we export a lot of manufacturing goods to the UK. They're one of our big customers there. They're not one of our top customers when it comes to agriculture. Do you see room for growth for agricultural products from Wisconsin and the rest of the U.S. to a trading partner like the United Kingdom?
I do. Now, obviously, this gets very complicated. Like us, the UK has a lot of domestic industries that it wants to make sure it isn't disadvantaging or protecting. But I think, again, if you resolve a lot of these disputes and if you strive to get towards that ideal of a level playing field, given how advanced both of our economies are, for example, given that we're both leaders when it comes to financial services, we run trade surpluses when it comes to financial services, I really do think we have an opportunity to break down some barriers. In any situation in which we allow Wisconsin farmers to sell more dairy or soybeans or whatever it is to foreign countries is a good scenario, because the fact is 96% of the world's customers are outside of the United States. So you need to have more than just a domestic market, and we need to constantly be clawing to open market share in countries that are pretty protectionist right now. That was actually one of the best provisions of USMCA. It convinced the Canadians to start opening up some of their dairy protectionist measures, and hopefully that will, over time, allow Wisconsin producers and farmers more access to that market.
Representative Gallagher, thanks a lot for taking the time today.
Thank you.
That's Representative Mike Gallagher, a member of Congress representing Wisconsin's 8th Congressional District. He was with us today to talk about what he wants to see out of a trade deal between the U.S. and the U.K. now that the country has left the European Union. Coming up, we'll get the latest on an active shooter situation in Milwaukee. That's up next on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, ice fishing, ice skating, even ice festivals. None of these would be possible if our winter ice were to melt. We'll talk to a researcher about what it means that our ice season is growing shorter. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Brad Kohlberg with a story about crying in front of your kids.
Tequila Benton has always tried to be strong for her kids. But the Madison storyteller wonders if that comes at a price.
It's a rare thing to get a glimpse of yourself from the outside. All of your hard work, love, devotion, the sacrifices and sleepless nights, and think, I'm a pretty freaking awesome mom. Well, this is not one of those times. It's more like one of those occasions surrounded by half-folded baskets of clothes and piles of books and papers, screaming, will you kids just leave each other alone? Why am I always stepping on Legos? That's it. Go to bed. Everybody just go to bed. I forced a smile recalling that day. I was very near losing it. It was an overwhelming day, I said to my son. But you didn't cry, my little guy responded. In that instance, I realized how my kids must have saw me. As someone who instructs them on how to handle emotional overflows, but fails to take my own advice. Surely I've cried in front of my kids, right? Well, when I was pregnant, I remember crying all the time. Those ASPCA commercials get me every time. But that was late at night, and I'm sure my daughter was sleeping. Maybe one of the times when the pain from my migraine reached a fever pitch. Probably not, since I prefer to hide in the bathroom, you know, in the dark, in the tub, with a blanket over my head. I tend to hide in the bathroom a lot, I think, when that uncomfortable emotional side of me starts taking over. Could that be why my kids refuse to allow me any privacy in the bathroom? Even if I'm on the toilet, they feel it's okay to burst in, mid-argument, forcing me to mediate from the porcelain throne. Locking the door doesn't help either. I see little tiny fingers underneath the door. They slide notes under there. Hear my son screaming, "Mom, Mom, I know you're not using the bathroom. You have your phone, I can see it. Poo particles are getting all over your phone." They don't know that I'm Googling affirmations because I'm replaying the last 14 years of my life trying to figure out what went wrong, and perhaps if I had cried more in front of their dad, he wouldn't have been so distant. He has told me on many occasions that he felt I was only open when I was crying and my guard was down. I wonder if my kids view me that same way. It bothers me as deeply as the constant tears that are ingrained on my shoulders that my mother cried on. I knew early on I didn't want to be emotional like that. I said I'd be a boulder like my grandmother, who I only ever saw shed a tear for my father's incarceration. Even when I saw her the last days of her life, laying in her hospital bed, she looked at me and smiled and motioned for me to come and sit next to her in the bed. I couldn't. I ran in the bathroom and cried, and I still regret that to this day. Moms do cry, I told my son, like when you leave your Legos on the floor and I step on them, or especially when your sister uses up all the data. Yeah, I cry. No, no, you curse, Mom. You don't cry. Okay, note to self, stop cursing, at least out loud. Or perhaps the next time I'm in the bathroom and one of them slides a note under the door, I'll write a reply back that says, "Mom is crying, do not disturb," and slide it back out to them, poo particles and all. Thank you.
Tequila Benton's story came to us from the podcast Inside Stories, which features Madison storytellers and digs deeper into their lives. She's the co-host of the podcast and originally shared that story at a Listen to Your Mother event. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Brad Kohlberg.
Now, when you live in a place with long winters, like Wisconsin or much of the Northern Hemisphere, you tend to make use of the resources it brings, like ice. Whether you enjoy a walk across your local lake or ice fishing, that adds some value to your winter. Maybe you attend a local festival or race that's centered around ice. If the cover on our freshwater lakes disappeared, what would we lose? That's part of what our next guest was looking into as the lead author of a study examining the cultural effects that declining ice cover can have on communities. Leslie Knoll is a freshwater ecologist and the station biologist at the University of Minnesota's Itasca Biological Station and Laboratories. She's also an adjunct assistant professor in the Department of Plant and Microbial Biology. Leslie, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, before we get into the cultural side of ice loss and ice melt in Wisconsin and Minnesota and elsewhere in the world, can you talk about what we're losing in terms of how much ice we see on our lakes from year to year?
Yeah, so over about the past century, lakes have been experiencing early ice breakup, later ice formation, and shorter seasons of ice cover. And there's also been studies have shown decreases in ice thickness and also increases in the frequency of freeze-thaw events. So that's like when a lake freezes and then you lose that ice and then it freezes again. So we've been seeing that in the northern hemisphere, including in the Great Lakes region where we are now.
A lot of times we would think of that story as a weather and climate change story, maybe an ecology story. You focused on the human side of things, the cultural ecology. What made you want to tackle that particular issue?
Yeah, so I've been working on lakes and more on the ecology side, either as a student or professionally for over 20 years now. But I find that I'm always kind of drawn to the how people are involved, that side of things. And I moved to Minnesota. I'm up in northern Minnesota about 4 years ago, and my office overlooks Lake Itasca, which is a very popular recreation lake. We're in a state park and at the headwaters of the Mississippi River. So I'm seeing a lot of recreation occurring in the summer and also in the winter. For example, I'm looking out my window now and I see 5 ice houses on the lake and trucks out there. So that kind of seeing this every day got me really thinking more about how people are using the lake in the winter and what they stand to lose. As we know, ice cover is changing over time.
What kind of cultural events here in the upper Midwest, places like Wisconsin, Minnesota, are feeling the impact of this reduced amount of ice?
Some of what we looked at and some of what's very popular in the upper Midwest, ice fishing, of course. Ice fishing tournaments is one thing that our study looked at. Ice skating out on natural lakes or hockey are pretty common events as well. But even thinking about things like taking pictures of the frozen landscape, people post tons of pictures on Instagram or just take pictures for their enjoyment. So really all of those kind of uses of ice that don't necessarily provide a material benefit. Although ice fishing does give you fish, there's also like the social part of it, right? And the activity. So,
and that's day-to-day kind of stuff. You also looked, I understand, at winter-themed events that rely on that ice that sometimes get canceled.
Right, yeah. So, like I said, the ice fishing tournaments, but as well, even different, you know, I know there's a famous ice castle that's built in Wisconsin, and we've got different ice palaces or different festivals that occur on the ice every year. And so those things can get canceled or modified, delayed, need to go to a different location depending on the ice conditions for the year. And with these changes we're seeing in ice over time, we're going to have more and more of that as time goes on.
You and your colleagues in writing this paper also look at other services ice offers, including, and this is around the world sometimes and over history, ceremonial or religious benefits. That's something I hadn't thought of. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, that is, I think, a pretty interesting example of ways people use ice. So one really long-standing tradition is in Japan, Lake Suwa, where there's been ice records since 1443 by Shinto priests who document the formation of an ice ridge. And so that ice ridge appearance is thought to be a message from God. So the ridge is formed by the footsteps of one god crossing the lake to visit another god. And so then that kind of starts a ceremonial process. And so they've been keeping these records since the 1400s, just for their religious purposes, not, you know, for any scientific reason. But then some scientists were able to, from actually the University of Wisconsin-Madison, were able to take advantage of that to relate it to climate change. And then we explored it a little bit further in our study. But that's one example. And then there's you know, numerous ones around the world. Russian Orthodox have Epiphany celebrations where they submerge themselves into icy lakes and rivers where they cut a hole. So there's different examples. There's a Catholic church on Lake Constance. Two Catholic churches actually have a procession where they have a statue that they march back and forth over the lake when it's frozen. So there are lots of different examples around the world.
And bringing things closer to home, you're able, based on where you are, if nothing else, to talk to people about how they feel the impact of not as much ice fishing or these event cancellations. What do people say? How do they talk about this decline of ice if they notice it?
A lot of times I hear more kind of thinking about the past and how they used to be out ice fishing in this area by Thanksgiving really reliably, and now that's not such a sure thing to have. So I hear that sometimes. But I don't often hear that kind of next step of going to climate change. So I think that's kind of interesting. But I think our study sheds light on kind of taking it to the next step and bringing in the records that we've got on ice cover that go back, you know, hundreds of years to show those changes and breakup and duration over time.
Leslie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you. This was a nice conversation.
That was Leslie Knoll. She's a freshwater ecologist and the station biologist at the University of Minnesota's Itasca Biological Station and Laboratories. She's also an adjunct assistant professor in the Department of Plant and Microbial Biology. She's the lead author of a study examining the cultural effects of ice loss on communities in Wisconsin and around the world. Coming up, from TikTok to Facebook, from menus to memes, different generations go online for different stuff. We talked to an internet reporter about the online habits of people of different generations and ages, and you can share your stories. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7 on The Morning Show, Kate Archer-Kent and her guest look at the verdicts in the Harvey Weinstein trial and what it means for his other upcoming charges and wider issues of sexual assault and the Me Too movement. That's tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Now, while the World Wide Web was effectively invented by a baby boomer, sometimes it's thought of as a place for younger people with internet lingo, TikTok, and the OK Boomer attitude. But the internet today is full for people of all ages. According to a 2017 Pew Research poll, 67% of adults age 65 and up say they use the internet, and 4 out of 10 older adults own a smartphone. While we may all be online, we don't all have the same ideas of what's entertaining, informative, or even safe online. Katie Natopoulos is a senior reporter for BuzzFeed News covering internet and technology. She co-hosted the podcast Internet Explorer. Katie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, this is something I think about a lot. We're all, you know, using the same internet, but it's going to feel really different depending on where you're coming from in many cases when it comes to different generations. What kind of things do you watch for when it comes to how different ages may go online?
I think that what's interesting is seeing, you know, typically younger people are the people who are adopting new platforms first, right? So something like TikTok is something that teenagers are really into right now and seems a little bit confusing for older people, even people my age. I'm in my 30s. as you said, everyone's online now. You know, internet penetration in the U.S. at least is pretty much near complete. And so you still have a lot of people of all ages who are, you know, daily, weekly, constant internet users. They have smartphones, they're on Facebook, they're interacting with these people, you know, the platforms and websites in all sorts of different ways.
Do you see this as a generation gap where we just don't necessarily understand each other when the younger person references TikTok now or Vine, 10, 15 years ago, whenever Vine was, that we don't even know what the other person's talking about?
Well, I think that one thing to consider is that, you know, teenagers and older people aren't necessarily hanging out and talking about TikTok very often. And so the points where you do see these two sort of generations connecting, you know, is parenting. So an older, you know, a parent in their 40s or 50s who has a teenager might feel really, you know, freaked out and concerned about, like, what is my 16-year-old looking at on the phone? And then also we see it in the workplace. You know, that's another area where people of many different ages all of a sudden have to come together and, you know, accomplish a task together, but they might have drastically different experiences. You know, and I think that there's different ways that in the workplace, people, you know, there's, you know, young people who are 20, 22, Gen Z is, you know, starting to work alongside baby boomers. I think that, you know, it's working out to some degree.
Do you see, it seems like there's some kind of a creep sometimes where younger people might adopt a platform and then older generations come to it. And, you know, with something like Facebook now, I think younger people in some cases steer clear of it because that's what the grown-ups use. Is that a trend you see over time?
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely happened with Facebook. I don't know necessarily that it's happened with other types of platforms as much as it really has with Facebook, where it, you know, it's the kind of thing that honestly, it's great for older people. It's a way to keep in touch with, you know, friends and family who, you know, you've met throughout your life that might not live near you, you know. So I understand why, you know, someone who has grandkids or children or adult children likes it as a way to keep in touch. You know, but then, of course, it's inherently uncool if you're young because you don't want to be on the same thing that your parents are on. But you don't really see that as much with services like TikTok or Instagram or even Twitter, things like that, YouTube, just because I think the older people are slightly less interested in being on YouTube or TikTok. And that, I mean, YouTube is its own sort of interesting thing where I think that's a platform really where those two generations are using it very differently. So older people, I think, look at YouTube as a repository of videos that they can go and search for the thing that they're looking for, right? You might want to see a cooking video. You might want to see a news clip. You might want to see, you know, a music video song that you remember from, you know, growing up or something like that. That's what I use it a lot for. And younger people go there as a social network. They follow personalities on there. You know, they want to see the daily update from Jake Paul or whatever. They're posting stuff on their own. They love watching the drama unfold between these, you know, different YouTube characters having fights and arguments with each other. So that's really something where there are really two different worlds of how you use the same thing. And everyone's using YouTube. You know, we look at videos all the time. But the way that they sort of view those things, I think, are very different.
Talking to Katie Natopoulos, she covers internet and technology at BuzzFeed News. We're looking at generation gaps on the online world. You can join in at 800-642-1234 if you're willing to tell us what generation you are and how you use the internet, and especially if you see differences with other generations, your kids, your parents, older or younger coworkers. Are you in different worlds on the internet, or have you found cool stuff from each other? 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. Now, you mentioned the grandparents or parents sharing pictures of their kids. And I know, Katie, different people, and I don't know if this is a generational thing, people have different attitudes about, you know, should we really be posting all these images of minors online? What do you see out there?
Something I've written about and I'm really interested in, and it happens a lot on Facebook and also on Instagram, but I think different generations have really different attitudes about privacy and what sort of expectations of how you should share stuff on the internet would be. And you might think that younger people are more, you know, ready to share any pictures or whatever. But I found that actually those people are a little bit more, probably because they're a little bit perhaps more aware of the different nuances in how to set your privacy settings on something like Facebook, which is, you know, Facebook tries to make it as easy as possible to figure out your privacy settings, but still slightly complicated. And so what I've seen a lot of tension with is, you know, millennial parents of babies and young children are having problems with the grandparents, their own baby boomer parents, about when it's okay to share photos of the baby or the child, and whether or not it's okay to share the public to, you know, to do it to a public setting, or, you know, if it's okay to tag their friends in it, or sort of the etiquette around that. I do see a lot of millennial parents being really cautious about how they are posting pictures of their children publicly on the internet. And a lot of parents really want to avoid sort of giving their child a digital footprint.
You mentioned the E word there, etiquette. I know people are actually writing books about online etiquette, but things change so fast. Is there any shared definition of what it means to have a system of etiquette online?
You know, I think that it's one of those things where it does change, and each platform is slightly different. And, you know, I don't know. I think that if you have good etiquette in real life, you can figure it out, you know. If you're someone who's prone to pissing off your millennial son or daughter, you might piss them off on Facebook too. So that kind of thing happens. And, you know, it's tough.
And then we've got people on all ends of the extreme. We've got younger generations who never knew life without the internet. Some members of the older generation who maybe adopted early, maybe didn't. Do you think that shapes the way we approach the internet or Gen Xers like me who kind of came in halfway through? Does that basic point of origin there shape the way we do things online?
It certainly shapes the way we do things online. I think it also even shapes the way that, people do things offline, almost even more so. I remember hearing just recently about, it was a story about some of the phone bankers for political candidates, when they have really young people who have only known cell phones, they don't understand how call waiting works. So they're not used to what a hold line is, or how to put someone on hold, because they didn't have their own landline. So they're not used to that kind of stuff. So, I think that as much as there's different expectations of how to use the internet and younger people might be more savvy at that, they're also not savvy at these sort of basic things like, you know, how to use a phone.
We're talking to Katie Natopoulos, senior reporter for BuzzFeed News, covering internet and technology. We're talking about how different generations view and use the internet. Well, now we want to hear from you, your stories, your anecdotes, your experiences at 800-642-1234. Whatever age you are, how has the internet impacted your life? What social media platforms do you go to? Do you see just your peers there, people of your own age group, or do you interact with other generations while you're there? Do you have misunderstandings in your own household with people talking about things they saw online, the memes, TikTok, whatever it might be? Call in at 800-642-1234 with your experiences, your observations, maybe your frustrations. 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about how different generations use the internet. Our guest is Katie Natopoulos, a senior reporter for BuzzFeed News covering internet and technology. She co-hosted the podcast Internet Explorer. You can join in, whether you're a boomer, Generation X, Generation C, millennial, wherever you are on the generation map, you can call in at 800-642-1234. Are you an older adult who is maybe skeptical of social media, of the internet, but now you use it? Maybe you're someone who sees family members of different ages spending their time online drastically differently, from getting the weather to recipes to using TikTok. Do you produce your own content online, or are you a passive observer? Where on the internet, no matter your age, have you found a community, if at all? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll go to your calls now. Hunter starts us off in Stevens Point. Hunter, hello.
Hi.
What do you want to tell us about, Hunter?
Okay, well, I think that a large aspect, especially for younger people, of the online social media occurrences are online gaming. I think that there's a large number of younger people who have met people from all over the world and interacted with them through that medium, and I just think it's a very interesting point that not a lot of people talk about when talking about the impact that the internet has had on, you know, my generation.
Hunter, can I ask how old you are and what your main online games are?
Sure. So I just turned 23. I play a lot of games like Overwatch, League of Legends, the occasional more massively multiplayer thing like World of Warcraft or something.
Hunter, thanks a lot for sharing that story. And Hunter, I know a lot of people do this. They have groups of friends that they know from playing online games like Overwatch and the rest. I don't know. Do you think that crosses generations or is this mostly a younger person thing? Katie.
It does cross generations. I mean, I think the people of all ages play video games, but it definitely is a little bit more concentrated with, you know, younger people. I mean, there also are, you know, as the caller pointed out, there's tons of huge services like Twitch that are dedicated to online streaming of video games. And that's a whole sort of level of social network that if you're not into gaming, you might completely miss. And I think that it is also a, you know, an interesting generational issue with parenting because there's a lot of games like Minecraft and even Roblox for younger kids that, you know, parents might not totally understand but are sort of good for kids potentially. And there's, you know, lots of sort of hand-wringing about screen time and not exactly understanding what your kids are doing when they're playing video games.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Mark is with us in Menominee Falls. Mark, hello.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. And that's to jump right on to what Hunter just called in about. But I grew up with the internet and met a lot of really good friends on it. In fact, the only people I'm really still in touch with from high school are people I've never met in real life and have only played games with online. I think that it definitely crosses the generation. So, too, I have people who I affectionately at least used to call my internet mother or father and just people of all ages I've gotten to interact with that I never would have in real life, but through a connection mostly in those massively multiplayer online games, I've made some really good friends.
Mark, I got to ask, have you ultimately met some of these people in person, or is this a purely online connection?
I have met a couple of them in person. We've had a few meetups, and it's kind of always a fun experience, you know, putting an in-game avatar and name and persona into a real person, and you find sometimes people who are completely introverted in real life can be themselves online and they don't really have the opportunity to do that in person, or they don't feel as comfortable being themselves.
Mark, thanks a lot for sharing that. Katie, people, again, meeting people online, but also, I guess, exploring different sides of their personas online. What do you think about what Mark had to say?
I mean, I think that that's absolutely one of the best parts of the internet is that, you know, you get to meet people who you wouldn't necessarily meet in your town or in real life or at your school, you know, especially for queer people or people of color who might not feel like they, you know, have a lot of peers like them around. The internet can be a great way to reach out and talk to other people like you. The Pew Research about teenagers has also showed that teenagers who use the internet, a really high percentage of them, one of the sort of benefits is that they say that they've used social media to talk to someone who isn't like them. So maybe someone from a different town or a different race or a different gender. And that's, you know, ultimately a positive thing.
Thanks a lot for that call, Mark. This jogs my memory, Katie, going way back to when Yahoo was the big deal and they ran TV ads. And there was one where there was a punk rocker and his friends made fun of him from sewing. And so online, he met a sewing group of old ladies and went and sewed with them. And I don't know, that was like the promise of the internet that you were going to find your people. And I don't know, it sounds like maybe some of that is coming true.
I think it's definitely come true. I think there's so many people who have really, really positive stories of how they use the internet to connect to a group of people who they never would have met in real life. You know, and those are success stories. I think ultimately there's some research that shows that even if you meet people online and online friends can be real friends, you don't actually necessarily have more friends. There's sort of this scientific rule called Dunbar's number that says you can only ever really have, human brains are only capable of having 150 friends. And even if you have 1,000 Facebook friends, you're not, they might be acquaintances, you can match the name and face, but you don't actually keep regular social contact with them, and that we're only, as you know, evolved primates capable of a certain amount of human interaction. So I think that we might find more enriching friendships by finding and connecting with the people that we want to find, but it doesn't necessarily mean we have more friends than someone who's completely offline and, you know, only has friends from real life.
Talking to Katie Natopoulos, senior reporter for BuzzFeed News, looking at the way we use the internet and generation gaps in how we use it, how we experience it, how we may not get each other. Katie, as a parent, I got to say I've discovered that there's a whole world of celebrities that I had no idea were out there. You were mentioning earlier the famous people on YouTube, the creators of TikTok things, the Twitch videos. There are a lot of people out there who are famous, but in that one circle, and another generation might be completely, as I was, ignorant of them.
Oh, yeah, totally. You know, and they're sort of self-contained, I think, of especially with the gamers. You know, there's people who are really, really famous gamers and have millions and millions of followers on these platforms like Twitch, and Microsoft has a version of a game streaming platform. And if you're not into video games, you would have never, ever heard of these people. Similar to YouTubers, it's sort of if you've never, you know, if you're not into that, you've just never heard of them. And that is slightly different than, you know, everyone's heard of Beyonce. You know, if it's a popular musician on the radio or an actor in movies, you probably, you know, have some awareness of them. But, you know, I think that that is a different way that, you know, there is this different level of culture that young people are into.
Do you see, as we start to wrap up, Katie, ways that we can maybe get more and more positive intergenerational interaction on social media or somewhere online?
I don't know. It's hard to say. I mean, I think that there is, you know, the whole OK Boomer meme, which is, you know, this sort of disdain for older people, you know, it is sort of based on the idea that older people, when they interact online, are often sort of looking down their noses a little bit at young people. You know, but I think that ultimately, like, there are positive ways that people can interact and be civil. But you sort of have to be open to it, I think.
And just briefly, Katie, I know you track developments online, memes, cutting edge. What are you watching right now?
You know, I really do like TikTok, I have to say. Even though it seems complicated, it's actually like the easiest possible thing. You open it up, you don't have to follow anyone. It just starts showing you popular and funny videos. And you don't, they're not even hard to get. A lot of the times they're just kind of funny videos. So I actually really, really enjoy just scrolling through that.
Katie, thanks a lot for joining us today. It's been a lot of fun.
Thank you so much for having me.
We've been talking to Katie Natopoulos, a senior reporter for BuzzFeed News covering internet and technology. She joins us today to talk about how different generations use the internet and social media. Still time, by the way, to share your thoughts, maybe your experiences online or in your own household with the different ways people use their technology. Head over to the Ideas Network Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Or TikTok us. No, that's not a thing you can do, right? Nope. The younger person here is shaking her head. You can't do that. But the Central Time Twitter feeds at Central Time WPR. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, the world lived in fear of nuclear war for decades. That fear is mostly gone. But the weapons, they're still here. The author of a new book shares the secret history of the bomb. There are a lot of ways an election can go wrong, from foreign interference to local mismanagement and beyond. An elections expert shares some meltdown scenarios on voting day and how to prevent them. Plus, we'll get the results of the newest Marquette Law School survey and what it says about Wisconsin's role in the presidential election. That and more tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow at 6, Kate and her guests look at the current state of the U.S. space program and the influence of mathematician Katherine Johnson, who passed away this week. That's tomorrow at 6 on The Morning Show. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then a new report finds there are more homeless teens in Wisconsin than some official statistics show, and they may not have access to help they need. We'll get the details. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.